Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford with a May 17th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. This is, as you may have noticed, the third Wednesday of May, when you would expect to hear Joy DeClaire with Fort Wright Radio, but because I had an opening of a photo exhibit in San Francisco last Wednesday, Joy graciously agreed to switch days with me. I'm glad to be back with you in these topsy-turvy, turbulent times created by the election to the White House of a self-absorbed, spoiled businessman whose ignorance is exceeded only by his ego, or is it the other way around? I'll have more to say about Donald Trump later, but first I want to let you know that following my news and commentary, I'll be speaking with Diana Johnstone in France about the closely watched presidential election there 10 days ago, in which a center-right candidate, Emmanuel Macron, easily prevailed over Marine Le Pen, whose anti-immigrant, fiercely nationalist positions were virtually indistinguishable from those taken by Trump during his own presidential campaign. That'll be 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. Before dealing with Mr. Trump's latest misadventures, there's good news for those who wished for the release from prison of Chelsea Manning, which was announced this morning on NPR, and for those who have long supported the Puerto Rican independence movement, which wasn't announced, that I wish to share with you. Today, after 36 years in federal prison, the Puerto Rican independence leader Oscar Lopez Rivera will be a free man. In Puerto Rico during the 1970s, for those of you who may not remember, several clandestine political organizations formed and carried out armed actions to protest the presence of the United States military on their homeland, which had been taken as the spoils of Washington's war with Spain over Cuba in 1898. In the U.S. between 1974 and 1980, one of the groups, the FALN, Armed Forces of National Liberation, claimed responsibility for the bombings of military, government, and economic sites, mainly in Chicago and New York, to call attention to the colonial status of Puerto Rico and to demand the freedom of the nationalist prisoners serving long sentences in U.S. prisons for their pro-independence actions in the 1950s. In 1980, 11 men and women were arrested and charged with seditious conspiracy, conspiring to oppose U.S. authority over Puerto Rico by force, by membership in the FALN, with weapons possession and transporting stolen cars across state borders. Lopez Rivera was not arrested at the time, but was named as a co-defendant in the indictment. The others were sentenced to terms in prison ranging from 55 to 90 years. The judge stated his regret he did not have the power to give them the death penalty. In 1981, Lopez Rivera was arrested after a traffic stop, tried and convicted on the identical charges, and sentenced by the same judge to prison for 55 years, despite having not been accused of any violent crime. In 1987, he received consecutive 15-year terms for conspiracy to escape, a plot apparently conceived and carried out by government agents and informants, resulting in a total sentence of 70 years. Upon his arrest, Lopez Rivera took the same position as had his co-defendants, that under international law, U.S. colonial control of Puerto Rico is a crime against humanity, that the courts of the U.S. had no jurisdiction to try him as a criminal, and that he should be remanded to an impartial international tribunal to have his status judged. While this stand was recognized by international judicial bodies, the U.S. government, which has a history of ignoring such opinions, proceeded to try him for the offenses mentioned. As his co-defendants had done, he presented no defense and pursued no appeal. From 1986 to 1998, Lopez Rivera was kept in total isolation. Then in 1999, when he was allowed to be part of the prison population, they barred him from having any contact with the media. In January, President Obama commuted his sentence, and today, when the prison doors open, Oscar Lopez Rivera, now 74 years old, will walk out of the door, his head held high, a free man. 2 weeks from tonight, on May 31st, at St. John's Presbyterian Church at 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley, there will be a reception honoring him as one of America's longest-held political prisoners. And though you won't hear about them on our national media, there are many more political prisoners still locked away, many for decades, almost all Black, Latino, or Native American. On the other side of the world, there are close to 1,000 of the 6,000 Palestinian political prisoners illegally held in Israeli prisons who are now in their 30th day of a hunger strike. Their story has been largely ignored by the U.S. media since NPR reported this beginning a month ago, and the New York Times ran an op-ed explaining the reasons behind the strike by its organizer, long-term prisoner Marwan Barghouti. As I mentioned in my last program, transporting Palestinian prisoners to Israeli jails is prohibited by international law, which Israel, like its American sugar daddy, has a long history of ignoring. What this is designed to prevent, among other things, is visits by family members who are not allowed to enter Israel, and that complaint by the hunger strikers has been endorsed by the International Red Cross. The Israelis attempted to break the back of the strike earlier this month by releasing a video taken from a ceiling camera that purported to be of Barghouti in solitary confinement, breaking his fast by eating a candy bar in the toilet area of his cell. His back, for the most part, is to the camera, and there's no indication when the video was made or who furnished him with the candy. It has not apparently had any effect on the other striking prisoners, nor on Barghouti, who is now taking not even water, according to the report yesterday. While all this has been going on, the unelected president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, met at the White House with Donald Trump, who may be unaware that Abbas's term in office expired in 2009. He only continues to serve in that position because of his continued collaboration with Israel and that there have been no Palestinian elections in the past decade. Abbas predictably made the usual noises about the need for Palestinian independence, and Trump reciprocated, speaking of the necessity for the Palestinians to have a sense of dignity that he would bring the two sides together. No sensible person with any knowledge of the situation could take either one seriously, but the charade will continue when Trump visits Netanyahu and Abbas next week in Israel and Bethlehem. In a meeting with 300 Israeli journalists and business people at his Ramallah headquarters before coming to Washington, Abbas bragged to his guests that, quote, the security relationship, and I say it on air, security coordination is sacred, and will continue it whether we disagree or agree over policy. Abbas was seen making his remarks in a video published by the Al-Quds newspaper. Known euphemistically as security coordination, U.S.-financed Palestinian intelligence and security forces work closely with Israeli occupation forces and Shin Bet, their FBI, to suppress any Palestinian resistance to occupation, which was part of the Oslo Agreement. The close collaboration between occupier and occupied was recently praised by Martin Indyk, the career Israel lobbyist put in charge of the peace process, quote-unquote, by President Obama. The IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, and the Shin Bet now highly appreciate Abbas's ongoing work with them, Indyk said in a talk to the APAC-spawned Washington Institute for Near East Policy earlier this month. In his remarks to the visiting Israelis, Abbas also praised the 1993 Oslo Accords, long viewed by Palestinians as a catastrophe, since it legitimized Israel's presence of 60% of the West Bank and turned the Palestinian Liberation Organization into a security subcontractor for the occupation, while Israel has continued to colonize Palestinian land. Some attacked Oslo from the start and opposed it, Abbas said, and I don't know why. It was a good starting point. It was the first time we had dialogue. We sat together. It was the first time I saw my friend Shimon Peres in the White House garden, end quote. It should be noted that it was Abbas who negotiated the Oslo Agreement with the Israelis with Arafat's approval and made all the concessions to the Israeli side. A very different view of the agreement was taken, ironically, by one of the Israeli negotiators, Shlomo Gazit, a former head of Israeli intelligence. Responding to a shouting pro-Israel critic of Oslo at a San Francisco synagogue shortly after the accords were signed, and the man who angrily compared it to the British sellout of Czechoslovakia at Munich, Gazit calmly replied, quote, I don't like to make such comparisons, but if it's another Munich, we're the Germans and the Palestinians are the Czechs, end quote. Now let's turn to the problems facing Donald Trump that are of his own making. Besides his firing of FBI Chief James Comey and the firestorm in Washington over his passing of classified intelligence information secured from Israel regarding ISIS to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak at a White House meeting the very next day, the White House has also managed to alarm the Israelis over conflicting statements coming out of Washington concerning Israel's relationship to the Western Wall in Palestine and East Jerusalem. Yesterday, at a press briefing about Trump's forthcoming trip to Israel, his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, twice refused to acknowledge that the Western Wall, one of Judaism's most holy sites, which the president plans to visit next week, belongs to Israel. McMaster's refusal to answer questions about who has sovereignty over the Western Wall came a day after the White House disavowed the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem's decision not to hold talks with Israeli officials on Trump's Western Wall visit because it's located in the Palestinian West Bank. That's a policy decision, McMaster noted. McMaster also suggested that Trump will travel from Saudi Arabia to Jerusalem, possibly keeping in mind the longstanding American policy to not recognize East Jerusalem occupied in 1967 as part of Israel. After visiting Saudi Arabia, which, according to Bloomberg News, has promised to invest $40 billion, that's B as in billions, in building U.S. infrastructure, Trump will land in Israel on May 22nd and meet with President Reuven Rivlin. He will lay a wreath at the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial and deliver the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. On his visit to the Western Wall, reportedly, the first by an elected U.S. president, Trump will not be accompanied by any Israeli politicians, at least as of the moment. His visit to the site, said McMaster, is meant to, quote, highlight the need for unity for the world's three great religions, end quote. McMaster also said that Trump will meet again with Abbas in Bethlehem. Well, the Wall Street Journal reports that Arab Gulf states have offered to take concrete steps to establish better relations with Israel if Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will make a significant overture aimed at restarting the Middle East peace process. The potential steps include establishing direct telecommunications links with Israel, allowing overflight rights to Israeli aircraft, and lifting restrictions on some trade. The Gulf countries, in turn, would require Netanyahu to make what they would consider to be a peace overture to the Palestinians. Such steps, according to the report, could include stopping construction of settlements in certain areas at the West Bank and allowing freer trade into the Gaza Strip. One pro-Israel reader who read the story on the Jewish Insider blog wrote, "Wow, that's a huge, huge win. Those are actually big concessions from the Arabs who, for relatively little. Seems like nothing has changed. Can you imagine the Arab states offering these concessions in exchange for mere goodwill gestures on peace in the past?" End quote. The explanation is that the Sunni monarchies are more concerned with the growing influence in the region of Iran, and their allowing Israel to use their airspace would make it easier for Tel Aviv to mount an air attack on Tehran. One thing that seems not to have changed with Donald Trump taking over the White House is the power of the Israel lobby, namely the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, over the U.S. Congress. It appears to be greater than ever. On my last program on April 26th, I reported that 90 U.S. senators had signed a letter apparently drafted by AIPAC and introduced by Florida Republican Marco Rubio and Connecticut Democrat Chris Coons, calling for the United Nations, Human Rights Council, and other U.N. agencies to essentially lay off its criticism of Israel's human rights violation and the expansion of its settlements. It was addressed to the Secretary General of the U.N. As both the UN's principal founding member and its largest contributor, the United States should insist on reform, the letter read. We are deeply concerned to international leadership, committed to international leadership and to advancing respect for human rights, but continuing targeting of Israel by the UN Human Rights Council and other UN entities is unacceptable, end quote. The letter was being circulated even as Israel was passing a new law that would allow for an increase in the demolition of the homes of Palestinians not on the West Bank but living in Israel who are Israeli citizens. In my last program, I expressed my appreciation to Dianne Feinstein and Bernie Sanders for not having signed the letter. It turns out I spoke prematurely. AIPAC apparently put the screws on the 10 senators who hadn't signed, and by April 28th, all 100 of them had put their names on the letter, which, as far as I can tell, and recall has never happened before. While there have been a number of 100-0 votes in the Senate on pro-Israel resolutions and legislation, since Virginia's Robert Byrd died, the last with the courage to say no to AIPAC and to Israel, the number of signatures on Senate letters regarding Israel has usually been in the high 80s. The first such AIPAC letter, containing the signature of 76 senators, was sent on May 22, 1975, in response to an announcement by President Gerald Ford that he was going to make a speech calling for a reassessment of U.S.-Israel relations and hinting that he would call on Israel to withdraw to its pre-1967 borders. Ford was furious with Israel and its Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, as was his Secretary of State, none other than Henry Kissinger, who had been trying without success to get Israel to withdraw from land in the Sinai it had captured from Egypt in 1973. To put pressure on Israel, Ford had delayed the latest shipment of fighters for 6 months. The letter to Ford, signed by the 76 senators, warned him in no uncertain terms not to meddle with U.S.-Israel relations, and consequently Ford never made the speech. The Israelis eventually complied with U.S. request, the shipment of fighter jets went forward, and Ford dramatically increased aid to Israel the following year. Donald Trump made certain commitments to Israel while he was running for office and after taking the oath. One of them was to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and be the first major country to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. A law passed by the Senate in 1995 called for such a move to take place, but also included a clause that required the president to sign a waiver twice yearly blocking such a move if it would jeopardize U.S. policy in the region, and each president, beginning with Bill Clinton, has done so. The next deadline is June 1st, 5 days short of the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, in which Israel captured all of Jerusalem and expanded its boundaries to three times its original size. If Trump does not sign the waiver, the move of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv will go forward. If he does sign it, he will have broken one of his major campaign promises. How long Trump remains in the White House may rest on how he is viewed by Israel and its U.S. supporters. And his forthcoming trip to Israel will give a hint of that. It's something I'll be discussing with Grant Smith, director of the Institute for Research in Middle East Policy, next Wednesday when I return to my usual schedule. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.